Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. And if you're hardwired to hate the sound of eating, do you have the right to tell a nearby nosher to keep it down? Is the cure for peanut allergies peanuts and hand-washing dishes? And what gives with so many lying about their lives on the front line? Joining us to get the bottom of these and other ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Sorry, I can't speak. I'm buffing my resume.
Yeah, seems like it's an epidemic, Art. But before we get to that, I just want to ask you, since it is sort of sweeping the nation, since we all saw Dakota Johnson looking so gorgeous at the Academy Awards on Sunday night, the star of 50 Shades of Grey. 50 Shades of Grey was the subject of your Everyday Ethics podcast last week, and We didn't really get a chance to discuss what you had to say about the ethical issues involved in 50 Shades of Grey. What did you say, Art Kaplan?
Well, you know, in one sense, what you do behind closed doors is your business, and I think this novel kind of perhaps gave people some ideas of things they might do that they hadn't been doing, and I don't mean affairs, but just a livelier sex life. But on the other hand, there's a lot of bondage and sort of power issues involved in 50 Shades of Grey, and that, I think, deserves a little more comment than just, oh, isn't that cute or isn't that risque? If it's all men sort of commanding women to do certain things, you know, people are going to say, well, if the women enjoy it, great. But I think it's deeper than that. There are some power issues in terms of who gets to tell who what and that sort of thing.
Well, also because the guy in this movie is like a zillionaire and she's a college student.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you've got power disparities there. She's excited that this rich guy takes an interest in her, and then he introduces her to all these practices. Sure, I get it. There's something exciting about that, and, you know, sort of Marquis de Sade kind of revelations of what people will do, again, behind closed doors in the bedroom. And I'm not calling for police surveillance or anything, but I do think you need to think harder than the critics have about 50 Shades of Grey. It's been treated as cute, and I think it sort of puts women back a bit in terms of, you know, being submissive, yielding to the dominant, rich, powerful guy.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of movies from A Pretty Woman, which was not involving bondage, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. the same sort of theory as The Prostitute with a really zillionaire guy and 9.5 weeks. She wasn't a prostitute. She was an art dealer, but it was the same kind of theory in that movie, too. It seems to be very popular.
Yeah. You know, Art, I'm sorry, Art, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems to me, you know, despite our drive for equality, let's put it this way, there's almost a Hollywood or fictional backlash where men are men and they kind of compel behavior and women submit, and that's kind of the right way to have the sexiest relationship. I think everybody has to work it out for themselves. Again, I'm not going to say that I know best, but I think you want to think harder about it in terms of, well, what are these roles? What's being touted to women, particularly young women, as to how they should behave, what they ought to be expected to do at the whim of a powerful guy, that sort of thing. It needs more discussion that isn't the only way to be, or that may not even be the sexiest way to be.
You know, we were discussing, I can't remember with whom this discussion was being had the other day, about the positive effect that media, culture, television shows, movies have on the society at large. We talked about Archie Bunker having a huge positive impact on race relations. Most recently, we were talking about Selma, I guess, the day after the Academy Awards. What's the evidence in your world that negative behaviors in movies reinforce or instigate negative behaviors in the real world?
A massive increase in emergency room visits due to misuse of sex toys.
Is that really true? Is that really true?
Yeah, it is true. People finding things stuck in places they shouldn't be.
So, oh, gosh.
That has gone up. There's one sort of evidence base, I guess.
I'd say so.
And, you know, you hear people talking about it. You hear people giggling over it. I can't say, you know, I've done a survey and I know that whip sales are up by 65%, but it just seems to me in the cultural dialogue on this one, it gets more snickering, more That's adventurous and exciting on the sort of daytime talk shows and that sort of thing than it does, hey, let's really talk here. Is that the best sort of relationship between equal partners, or could we not have to beat each other to kind of get thrills, that sort of stuff?
Let's move on to Oliver Sacks. By the way, Oliver Sacks, people may know him best from his great book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, teaches neurology at NYU, which is where you also worked. Do you by any chance know Oliver Sacks?
You know, I don't. He came and I came at the same time, and I'm sad to say I've only met him once. I really have not had a chance to meet him in any great length or detail.
Well, in any case, he wrote this, I think, fantastic op-ed in the New York Times a couple of days ago called My Own Life, talking about his being diagnosed with terminal cancer. He's 81. But he talked about facing the last months of his life. What'd you make of it, Art Kaplan?
I thought it was great. He basically said, you know, I got a lot of living to do in my last month. He basically took the point of view that, you know, even at the end game, one could still be a contributor, one could still enjoy life. I think cancer sometimes robs people, as I've watched people die from it, of some of that energy and verve. You know, you don't really take that attitude right to the end because you really become weak and you become, in many ways, disabled. But as that time that he has left before that final stage occurs, I thought he gave a good optimistic and kind of teachable moment there about how to grapple with mortality.
I want to read a paragraph. I love this. I feel a sudden clear focus and perspective. This is Sacks writing in the Times. There's no time for anything inessential. I must focus on myself, my work, my friends. I shall no longer look at NewsHour every night. I shall no longer pay any attention to politics or arguments about global warming. This is not indifference, he writes, but detachment. I still care deeply about the Middle East, about global warming, about growing inequality, but these are no longer my business. They belong to the future. I thought that was really beautiful. Actually,
you know, Art, this reminded me a lot of I did a story a while ago for my second job at the Globe. I write for their website, Crux. It's a Catholic website. And anyway, I did a story about the Conversation Project, which is the brainchild of Ellen Goodman, who used to be a columnist at the Globe. And one of the things she said was that, like, women rewrote childbirth in the 70s, you know, where it became much more, you know, dad was there and natural childbirth, et cetera, that baby boomers are rewriting death. And you look at this Oliver Sacks piece. I don't know if at 81 he'd be a baby boomer. I guess he's too old to be a baby boomer. But anyway, this Oliver Sacks piece, the Atul Gawande book about mortality, the piece he did on Frontline about dying, the Conversation Project. There seems to be, she seems to be right. There seems to be a lot more talk about how you want to die.
I agree. And I think we are rethinking that, although it is my job on this program to dump and ruin all the any optimistic thought that Marjorie might have. But
let
me do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you see Still Alice, the movie about...
No, I should.
Julianne Moore.
I've been avoiding it because I don't want to think about it.
Yeah. Well, it is another in this genre of ways to think about one's dying, so to speak. She, in this case, isn't immediately dying, but she's, you know, disappearing because of the Alzheimer's.
Right.
And here's the downer. What was it? This is my Debbie Downer moment here.
Okay.
Saturday Night Live. A lot of the rewriting and rethinking about death are by people who have means. In the Still Alice movie, she goes and looks at some wonderful nursing homes and decides she doesn't want to be there. In my experience, very few poor people go look at wonderful nursing homes and decide anything because they couldn't afford to get into them anyway.
Yeah.
And people talk about their projects and how they want to go and being surrounded by their relatives and I might do home hospice. That's an entitled point of view about how to die. Most Americans still can't get to that. So there is a kind of, I don't want to say it's a 1% issue, that's not fair, but there's a haves and have-nots issue that's in the background here.
Well, all right.
Is that grim enough for you?
Yeah, but that raises a question in my mind. What is the deal with the Affordable Care Act and hospice care? Would that be covered if under Obamacare?
You know, hospice care would be covered, but there's a slightly different problem which people always forget about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act.
What?
It doesn't mean there's a hospice where you live. It doesn't mean there's a hospice that would take you. It doesn't mean that you could do home hospice because there may not be a home hospice that knows how to manage somebody with your Parkinsonism or whatever your terminal illness. So remember, I've said this, I think, grimly on this show before, it's great if you have health insurance. you can bite on the cord while you're trying to figure out who's going to care for you.
Well, one last thing about this. What about you hear...
God, I'm hanging up on myself.
Yeah, you hear a lot about a hospice in hospital, sort of the palliative care, which seems to have a lot more currency now. What about that?
Better. That's an improvement that everybody gets. So we didn't have palliative care services. Even 15, 20 years ago, this is people who really manage your pain.
Yeah.
Try to provide a little bit of emotional and psychological support, too. It's a specialty. I won't say every hospital and every nursing home has what it should, but it's growing. It's better. That's a real plus. I think there, if you're dying with a lot of pain, something's wrong with your hospital care.
Okay, so let's move to something much more upbeat, lying about your involvement in war.
That's right.
A couple of weeks ago, we spoke to you about Brian Williams, about mistaken memory and you dismissing in that case. Since it is an epidemic. We discussed this with Brian McGrory, the editor of the Globe, a few minutes ago. We have the head of the VA, who was much celebrated. He's going to come in and fix this mess. Lied to a homeless veteran, caught by CBS News, about his service in Special Forces, which he did not. He also lied.
By the way, I have to interrupt here and say, could we make this up? Where is Charles Dickens? The head of the VA lies to a homeless man?
Yeah. I know.
A homeless veteran, even worse. And then he also lies about how many people have been fired as a result of the mess at the VA hospitals or misrepresents. Then, of course,
did he get into it with a congressman about who served where and had a big fight with a congressman who was criticizing him, saying, who are you to tell me stuff? And it turned out the congressman was a two-term combat vet.
No, actually, that was Bill O'Reilly threatening the New York Times reporter. She wrote a story about... So we have the VA head, we have O'Reilly on the heels of the Brian Williams thing. What do you make about it? I mean, all bad things come in threes, but what's the message here? What's the theme?
I think there's a couple of themes. First of all, I think people do buff up their resume, what I joked about when I started. I think there's a sort of, I can't be secure enough no matter what I do. I've got to look a little better. So if I want to command authority or be trusted or be a reliable source, I better make sure that people understand I have virtues. And when you don't have virtue, as we say in ethics, you know, you don't have character and courage and authority and wisdom and all those things, well, you try to add it. So I think it's a human impulse. I think it's one you should resist, but I think that's part of what's going on. I also think we're getting a little bit weirded out by, let's call it, fictional accounts that pretend to be true. And so the line between truth and fiction is getting a little blurry in people's minds, right? I mean, we have all kinds of books written about who said what in the Oval Office by nobody who was there, right? They reconstruct things. We've got a journalism, if you will, and I don't mean media like we're doing, but I just mean a kind of world of fiction and so on, where people find it hard to say, well, was that really true, or is that just sort of a little bit fictionalized, but that's okay because close enough, so to speak. I think we're tolerant of too much marginal lying and getting out there at the edges. Last complaint about this sort of lying epidemic. Look, I did it too. I did it in high school. I think I scored more touchdowns in talking to girls who were from different towns than any human being since the Heisman Trophy winners. But then I realized that's bad because you get caught. You shouldn't do that anymore. And even later I realized it's not even fair. It's just not good to do. But I just wonder if we don't put up with it as, again, kind of a... Oh, that's just guys being guys kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I think we often put up with it, except at least in my estimation, when it relates to war and people actually putting themselves at risk. Yeah, I want to change gears and talk about another NYU, maybe colleague of yours, because this guy is connected to the Langone Medical Center. Do you know Baron Lerner, the doctor?
I do. Okay. In fact, here, just in disclosure, I'm his boss.
Oh, you are. Oh, well, I guess you do know him then. So I'm reading this piece, am I pronouncing this right? Misophonia, is that the word?
Yeah.
Okay, I have, and I'm not joking, I have misophonia. I didn't know.
Oh, why are we not surprised?
I didn't know.
We don't know what it is yet.
It was a condition.
Sure, yeah.
I'm not going to name names. There's a friend of mine who, when this person drinks water, the sound of that person drinking water drives me out of my mind.
It's me.
Okay, fine.
And it's insane on his part, I would say.
When I hear people, I'm not joking about this. When I hear people, and most people don't even hear this, when I hear people tapping their toes out of anxiety or nervousness or what, it drives me crazy. So what is this thing and how common is it? And I assumed I was one alone, but I'm not apparently.
No, there are plenty of people who are driven. I mean, at the far end, there's the fingernails on the chalkboard kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody seems to have particularly irritating sounds and background noises that drive them nuts. If I'm in bed with my wife and I turn on the radio and listen to it while she's trying to fall asleep, just as bad as, you know, I couldn't do anything worse. It drives her absolutely crazy. She wants absolute silence. She doesn't want to hear any of that stuff. It led me actually to buy a little earpiece so I could do that, since that's her particular noise that drives her nuts. But it's just a description. I mean, it's not a disease. It's just saying there are a bunch of behaviors, sounds, that really get under people's skins, and it is true. Why it is, we don't know. Is it a disorder? I'm not sure what Barron thinks. I don't think so. I think he's just describing a real-world phenomenon that we haven't paid much attention to.
Yeah, I don't buy this for 2 seconds, I have to tell you, Art Kaplan. I think this is an intolerance of your fellow man. Because what about Jim drinking the water himself, or the sounds of Jim chewing? If I were chewing, that would drive Jim insane. But Jim also chews. So how come Jim's own chewing doesn't drive Jim insane? Or
because I have misophonia and you don't is the obvious answer
to
the question.
You have misophonia.
Yes, I do.
I think it has something to do with people thinking that maybe – you know, they don't, well, I can't use that expression on the air.
I know, you surely can't use
that expression on the air. But it's a perspective. You know, it's like, I think it drives a lot of people a little nuts when people are eating, that the classic example they give of eating popcorn at the movie theater.
Yeah.
But you also chew popcorn at the movie theater. So does the alleged person suffering from misophonia drive themselves insane by their own chewing or their own popcorn chewing?
I
bet not.
First of all, let me say, I think they're all insane. They're not tolerant. So what Jim should do is move away from you when you're drinking. And if it gives him less airtime, well, you know, he's got 50 other media outlets. He'll make it up.
Exactly.
So,
I was going to ask you what the cure is, but apparently that's the cure, right?
I just think it's a description. It's just like you eat popcorn at the movies. Well, it makes it harder for me to hear the movie. I'm not sure I'm bothered by the sound of people eating popcorn. I just don't want to hear it when I'm trying to listen to the soundtrack. That's what's going on. But
you know what? Wait. You know what I love about this? We're talking to, I hope people know, literally the premier medical ethicist in America. Someone with whom he is speaking is talking about how he has a condition, me. And what does the premier medical ethicist do? Mock the person with a condition.
Yeah, you're always...
Isn't that unethical?
You're always trying to excuse yourself by claiming you have conditions, though. That's the bottom line here.
Exactly.
Art.
Didn't we say a few things about the virtues, courage, tolerance, that these are good characteristics to have? You can't always hide behind what's called disease mongering.
That's making up
a condition for everything you don't like.
That doesn't work.
There's no personal responsibility there.
I stand
exactly.
chasing. Thank
exactly,
you very much.
Jim. Thank you very much. So let's move on to this story, which I find absolutely fascinating. This deal about how this study that shows that if people wash their dishes by hand instead of putting them in the dishwasher where they get, I guess, cleaner, your kids might be less likely. I mean, you have to do other things too, like buy things more from farms and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called the hygiene hypothesis.
Yeah.
About children raised in particularly sanitized environments and what could happen to those kids. Tell us about this. I find this absolutely fascinating.
This is linked up to something else. I know you have it in your sort of quiver there of things to talk about, which is the peanut allergy.
Yes.
But they're, it's all of a piece here. So people worry about peanut allergy and they don't feed their kids peanuts. They just take them out of the diet. Well, it turns out the way you get used to peanuts is by getting some exposure to them when you're really little. That was the finding that came out in this remarkable paper that just got published in, I think it was New England Journal, actually, that said, you know, the best way to avoid peanut allergies is to expose. And that's what this hygiene hypothesis is. If you keep everything super clean, you're going to wind up making kids allergic when they first get exposed because their immune system, the body's defense system, doesn't build up any resistance to anything. So if you run around wiping the counters 24/7, if you run around, you know, cleansing everything everywhere, and you pull out of the diet anything that might get a reaction from your child, then you're going to get a reaction later, because at some point you will be exposed. But now you're exposed with an untrained or under strengthened immune system. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So what does that mean for parents? What should parents...
It means that filth is good. So you should send your kid out to some filthy place, let him crawl around in the mud and lick the dog, lick you. It's also, listeners will know, this is what drives me insane about the vaccine debate, when somebody says, oh, I'm so nervous they're going to get exposed to a lot of things in a vaccine all at once. If you let the dog lick you, for example, not you, but the baby, which most people do, and they put the cat next to the kid. Do you know where those animals have been? Now, I'm not saying don't do it. What I'm saying is that's the way the world teaches our bodies to deal with all these little viruses, bugs, and nasty things that are trying to get us. So you're not doing the right thing if you try to isolate or live in a bubble.
You know, the sound of dogs licking people's faces drives me crazy, by the way. I just want you, just puts me to, okay, before we leave.
Now, you know what that's called? That is a disease. That's called cranky old man.
Okay, fine.
Hold on one second. Before we do leave this thing about the alleged disease or it's not a disease, you said, this misophonia condition, mm-hmm. I guess. I don't think, maybe you did answer me, and if you did, I'm sorry, Art, but if you didn't, I would love this Dr. Lerner to answer the question about, so how do people who supposedly have misophonia react to the noises they make themselves?
Are they object to in other people?
Are they equally disgusted and enraged?
No. Okay. They are basically, another disease term, selfish.
Okay.
So
okay.
Listening to themselves chew,
okay,
it's grandiose, it's great, it's wonderful.
Okay.
Live for the sound if they're crunching, but if it's you, they don't like it.
Okay, Art Kaplan, so last week, the Everyday Ethics Podcast was 50 Shades of Grey. I assume this week, it's Deep Throat. Am I correct? No, what are you doing this week, really?
No, this is not retrospective Thursday or something. We're not going back. But
what are you doing?
We are doing something, which I think maybe we'll talk about next time we chat, which is an editorial that appeared in the Annals of Internal Medicine calling for gun safety by all the major American medical groups and the American Bar Association. So if doctors and lawyers agree on anything, I think that deserves notice. And they're saying, forget fighting about the right to own a gun. What are we going to do about gun safety?
Next Wednesday. Yeah, Art Kaplan, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He is the co-host of what you just heard us talk about, the Everyday Ethics Podcast. And Art happily joins us every Wednesday. Coming up, a decorated war veteran turned novelist, Elliot Ackerman, joins us to talk about putting his experience of the Iraq and Afghanistan war into words. He is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.